Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Coming up on this Tuesday edition, more violence against police officers last night in the United States. We've got the details about a couple of incidents that occurred. Also, a warning about a potentially dangerous do-it-yourself project that some kids are doing. It can be a lot of fun, but there's also some potential danger. We've got the stories there. And the Korean Peninsula continues to be a volatile region. Are they going to be able to solve their problems? That and more in this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. And online, we are at kpcg.fm. Live link at thetrumpet.com as well. If you would like to follow us on Twitter, go ahead and do that at kpcgfm. And you can email us anything you'd like to send, comments at kpcg.fm. We appreciate that. I'm Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, and Abraham Blondeau here today. And some violence last night against some police officers, unfortunately, that pops up in the headlines from time to time. We've got some details about that coming up. Also, a lot of other stories I think you're really going to be interested in. Starting today, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Make sure that you do listen for that. If you didn't catch it early this morning at 7 a.m., you can always catch the replays, or they're online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com. Really great information there in the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, so check those out. Also, thetrumpet.com, some stories today. How America helped Germany conquer Europe. A lot of the featured stories today relate to what the Trumpet Daily was about yesterday, the big news about Germany and how they're moving forward and conquering Europe. We talked about it some yesterday. A lot of great information at thetrumpet.com about that. If you haven't kept up with it, now is a good time to look at it. It's a big deal here in Europe.
Yeah, it's. I think the closer we get to all these big elections, France, Germany, with the presidential elections coming up, I think the more and more the headlines at thetrumpet.com will become more relevant to people as they see things fulfilled in front of their eyes.
Yeah, and what's nice about it is there's a couple of related stories as well. Of course, that how Germany won World War II, that radio show from yesterday, and then Germany's conquest of the Balkans, written by a Trumpet editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, and that's from years ago. So it's nice because you can look at the headlines today, and you can go back and look at the headlines, or you know what was written years ago about them. You see that it's happening. You can see that in the Middle East region with Iran. Talked about that being the king of the south for years. Germany's conquest of the Balkans, talked about that for a long time. And so now you can see it happening in the headlines. So it's good to go back and look at the older stuff.
Yeah, and it is shocking to just take the long view of the last 7 years, especially how we basically rebuilt Germany and even in Europe gave them the reins in the 90s by attacking the Serbs, who were actually our allies in World War II. And in doing that, we were helping the Croats and the Germans, who were our enemies in World War II. So it just shows that maybe we did have a disregard for history there. It's almost infuriating when you think about it a lot.
Yeah, because I remember that happening. I was in college at the time when that war was raging. And just the media, if you were to just believe what the media said about it, you would think that the Serbs were the bad people and they were going to exterminate the other races in the area. And they talked a lot about, you know, World War II, and we've got to step in there. We can't let it become a extermination-type situation. But really, they had a pretty distorted view of it. So that's – but, you know, if you're just listening to the mainstream media, that's you get the story you get, and it's not always accurate. Sometimes it is, but not always.
Yeah, that's a really particular case where – the media made up deliberate facts to persecute the Serbs and to make them out as the enemy. I think more so just to justify the actions of President Clinton and the European countries there involved. When in World War II, the Serbs suffered the most cruelly, probably from persecution besides the Jews, from the hands of the Croats and other things. And we also violated a promise we made to Russia not to intervene in Yugoslavia, but we did. And I think, well, I know Gerald Fleury has a Key of David on that, how Putin still remembers that, and he still makes him very upset that we broke international law essentially in Yugoslavia, and now we're up in arms about him doing something in Crimea that's pretty much the same thing.
Yeah, it's really interesting how one event happens and it's dominoes. It affects a lot of other regions. Vladimir Putin, of course, he was in, I think, Eastern Germany when the wall fell, and that really impacted him, bothered him greatly. He thought the destruction of the Soviet Union was one of the greatest disasters of the 20th century. So now we're dealing with him on the world scene. And those events, Yugoslavia, the fall of the Berlin Wall, very much impact his thinking, and now he's a big player on the world scene.
Well, yeah, it's almost like we created the monster that we're facing now, because the things we have done have actually motivated him to pretty much hate America above everyone else.
Yes, he's quite an interesting character if you read some of his history, and there's a lot on thetrumpet.com about him as well. Here is a few stories that happened overnight. A few officers shot in different locations, one here in Oklahoma, sadly. Two cops were shot in an ambush-style attack in South Florida late Monday. Miami-Dade police said that the two plainclothes officers were conducting surveillance in an unmarked vehicle when an assailant approached them and opened fire. The homicide unit officers, who CBS News reported were potentially undercover, were rushed to a hospital in the back of a pickup truck. They're alive, as far as I know. Related story then here in Oklahoma. An Oklahoma police officer died Monday morning after a shootout during a police pursuit. Local law enforcement officials said Justin Turney, 22, who was transported to intensive care at a local hospital before undergoing surgery Sunday night, he did not survive. So a couple of, or three shootings there. And it's been a rash of those lately. It's a sad thing to see.
I think it's important to realize that the police actually do face life and death situations every day. It's not just this whole story about police brutality where they're the only ones who could possibly inflict any damage. They're facing the same things. And so if we all sort of try to empathize with those police officers, or at least sympathize with them, then we might understand what they're facing and why they make certain decisions. It would be interesting to see exactly how many famous people are going to be protesting the killing of police.
Right. Yeah, you don't see that happen. Altogether, 135 officers were killed in the line of duty last year, according to preliminary data compiled by the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund. In contrast, 123 officers died in the line of duty in 2015. That's 10% fewer. So we've gained 10% more deaths in the last year. And Turney is the ninth officer to be shot and killed in 2017. He's also the first officer fatally shot in Oklahoma, according to the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund. So that's those are interesting numbers when you look at them. And you pair that with some of the other headlines today about how some of the big cities are saying we're going to be sanctuary cities, we're going to let illegals roam, crime and violence on the rise, people fleeing the big cities. We talked about that last week. Not good news any way you look at it.
Yeah, there's a prominent, I believe, sexual assault case taking place with one of those refugees or illegals right now. So it just goes to show that those types of decisions are detached from reality. And even here in Oklahoma, where a police officer was killed, that's really rare, but you still hate to hear anything like that happening. And especially when there are certain policies in place that tend to encourage these activities, or even certain statements that encourage this type of activity.
Yeah, the situation in Oklahoma here, from what I read about it, it was a traffic stop and the person took off. And they didn't release all the details, but they think the person had a lot of warrants. So that's the thing, you know, people can be a little bit, I suppose, upset occasionally if an officer pulls them over and they seem to be a little on edge. But these situations happen. You don't know necessarily who you're pulling over and what might occur. Could be just a normal traffic stop. It could be more serious.
Yeah, well, it's, I think, especially with the terrorist attack in London, a police officer was stabbed in the chest defending Parliament. And especially even in Oklahoma here, one dying, I think it reminds us that they're the ones who are the thin line standing between us and chaos. And there aren't too many of them there when you look at the population of America. And I think it's foolish, as many other people have said, to take the side of the criminals, or even if the officers make mistakes. I mean, they're dealing with life and death situations. No one is 100% perfect dealing in those. I mean, if any of us were in their shoes, I'm sure we would make a million mistakes in a matter of seconds when you're dealing with those kind of situations. So the fact that they make mistakes sometimes, it happens, and they are accountable. There are punishments for it. But we need to remember that they're the ones who do defend us, and it's a high foolishness to think that there's a better solution to saying there's no laws and let everyone do what they want.
Yeah, and in a lot of the cases that have been very public, they really didn't even make mistakes.
Yeah.
They actually did the right thing, but it's been spun to make it out like they did. So, yeah, there's no profession in the world where you don't make a mistake. You know, but it's a really tough magnifying glass to be under, where you have to be right all the time, every time. So, and they do a pretty good job in general. So sad to hear that, but worth talking about. You guys ever go out by the ocean, see the whales jumping out of the water?
Not in a long time, but half.
You've
once.
Seen it, if yeah. not in person, probably you've seen footage of it. It's a pretty common thing. Well, scientists have discovered they think the real reason why whales jump. I didn't know it was a question, but apparently it was. Here's the answer. They think. This is from Coastal Living. In a scholarly article published in Marine Mammal Science, the team pinpointed specific surface behaviors, its term for the whale's actions, as they breach or slap the water with their fins and what they might mean. It noticed the whale's surface behaviors became more common on windy days or when there were other groups of whales very far away. So that supports the opinion that whales use these behaviors as a form of communication. If there's something that would get in the way of them communicating as they normally would, I guess underwater, they jump up and make a bigger noise to get attention. That's what they think anyway. Interesting.
Yeah, that's not a bad theory. I mean, they're overcoming whatever is getting in the way of their normal communication. I think there's probably other people think other theories, showboating. I mean, animals still, they do things to get attention of females or whatever too. And
maybe that's what they're communicating. Hey, yeah. Look at me over here.
I did see a video the other day of a orca whale or a killer whale cartwheeling a seal off its back fin about 50 feet in the air.
Really?
Yeah, the seal was swimming and trying to get away, and the whale went underneath it and then flipped.
Yeah.
Flipped over itself, and its tail came in the water and flipped the seal about 50 feet in the air. And I have no clue what happened to the seal, but
yeah, that
it was
crazy. That could be a lot of fun or terrifying. You know, I'm not sure. I'm not sure how the seal would feel about that. Maybe that's a game they're playing.
Yeah.
Or maybe the whale was irritated. We're not sure.
That's going to be a very painful impact coming down from 50 feet, though. The water is almost like cement at that point.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting. They're fascinating animals, all the sea life, I mean, and the whales especially. So they think that might be one of the reasons they jump out of the water. Who knows? But if you get a chance to go see them, it's always great to do that. You've seen them in person, you've said.
Yes.
Yeah. Bob, up there in Canada on the coasts.
Yeah. Yeah, Nova Scotia, there's a few, and then I didn't go on whale watching on off the coast of BC, but I think some family members of mine did.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's neat when you do see them.
Huge animals, amazing animals. Here's something you might want to take note of if, kids get into these types of things. This is a do-it-yourself slime project that kids have been doing, I guess. But it can burn you. It doesn't always do it, but it did in this case. It brutally burned an 11-year-old girl. Massachusetts family is warning others about the dangers of do-it-yourself homemade slime. As an adult, that would never cross my mind, but kids want to do that. After their 11-year-old daughter suffered second- and third-degree burns on her hands, which doctors said is likely the result of prolonged exposure to one of the recipe's key ingredients, the girl said it felt really hot and tingly, and then it got worse. They picked the girl up. She was staying at a friend's house. They were doing this, and she was crying, and she had blisters all over her hands. They thought the reason they like to do it, they thought it's a fun experiment. It's kind of like a scientific thing, and it's kind of a neat thing to do, but it can burn you. They think it was in because of borax 1 as a key ingredient that burned her hands.
Oh. Yeah, if you do stuff like that, you probably need, there probably was adult supervision over the experiment, but whenever there's chemistry involved, if the wrong chemicals used or too much exposure, if it's mixed wrong,
mm-hmm.
there's always some kind of reaction, and it might be something like that.
Yeah, a lot of people said that they have had their kids do this, never been a problem, but I guess you got to watch it or just be careful. A lot of things can happen there, but that's the ingredient, borax 1. And she had her hands in it too much. She had second and third degree burns on her hands. It's interesting. I don't know exactly where they got the recipe from, but a lot of this stuff comes off the internet. You see from time to time people do these challenges. Sometimes they're fun or it's a fun experiment. Sometimes they're just silly. There's been a few over the years I can think of, and they always have to have the warning. Don't do this. You're going to get hurt. But that stuff spreads now because of the internet. It goes viral.
Right, yeah. And if you think about science experiments in a controlled environment, they always make you put on all of these different precautionary articles of clothing like gloves and coats and even goggles. I doubt that's really the case in a home project. So even if she had some type of rubber gloves on, it might have helped.
Anything to be a little bit on the safer side there. So the mom feels really bad, obviously.
Yeah.
She bought all this stuff and they were excited to do it and then the kid got severe burn. So there was nothing illegal going on there, just a mistake, and it can happen. So you got to be careful.
Yeah. Well, I remember going to friends' houses getting hurt all the time. And it was just accidents, and it just happens. And I think the time I got hurt the most wasn't chemistry, but we were trying to play baseball because my friend played baseball. And I was playing back catcher. But either I think it's his fault because I was stationary, and then he moved too close to me. But he swung in on his follow through, came, hit me right in the side of the head.
With a bat?
Yeah.
Ooh.
So that hurt quite a bit.
Yes.
And maybe there's lasting effects to this day. People don't tell me though. But that's the only thing I remember from that point.
Did it knock you out?
It didn't knock me out. I was on the ground and I remember like crying and holding my head and that kind of thing. We just lived a couple houses down from them in our little cul-de-sac. So. But I don't think it knocked me out.
Yeah, you have to. That's always one thing to be careful with kids in baseball is swinging the bats. That happened in grade school, not to myself, but another kid standing in line. Kid swung the bat in gym class, caught him right in the face.
Yeah.
And he was okay, but he had a pretty banged up eye for a while. Boy, that can do some damage. But that was back in the day of just shake it off. Right. Now you'd be in concussion protocol, which may be a good thing, but back then it was like, get back out there. You're okay.
I feel bad for a lot of parents in situations like this, especially when the story gets so much attention, because it seems like there's a whole lot of wrath directed at the parents when, you know, you can't control every tiny thing that your kid does. You can do your best, but the second you turn away, you know, they could be falling into a gorilla cage like we even saw in Ohio. I mean, how that woman was just, you know, torn apart for the fact that she turned away and then her child just fell in there. It's just... Sometimes, you know, kids are towing the line of disaster, and if you're criticizing the parents that much, it probably just means you don't have kids and can't relate to it.
Yeah, you have to really keep your eye out. That's especially when they're little, because they will do whatever you don't expect. They'll do some crazy things, and you know, the most panicky I've ever been, well, I think it was my son when he was quite young. We were in a store, and I just turned away for a second. I turned back, and he wasn't there.
Right,
and he did is walked around to the other side of this little rack. And I found him right away, but I tell you what, that 2 seconds, you're terrified.
I actually got lost in Harrods, that huge department store in London, mm-hmm. years ago, and it was the same thing where I turned away for a second, and then my parents were gone, but they thought
they left you.
They thought I was following them, but right. I wasn't paying attention, and then I'm sure they turned around and saw I was gone too. But it's just one of those things where you just have to hope you're being protected.
Yeah, this day and age, you just have to really, really watch. So anyway, if the kids are wanting to do some sort of do-it-yourself project, then make sure you're there with them and watch the borax. Could be serious. But that even highlights the fact you just have to be careful where you put different stuff in your house, cleaning agents, things like that. Kids can get into it just accidentally. I've been cleaning the garage lately. And I always think about, you know, like the big clippers and stuff. I'm going to put those up higher, you know, because it'd be easy to pull it down. And all of a sudden, you got a finger problem. So you just have to really watch where you put stuff.
Yeah, or cutting electrical wires, that kind of thing. So, I know people who have dogs they, if you leave them in the yard, they'll chew through them and get shocked, and now you're short a $20 extension cord. And so with kids, I mean, all that kind of stuff can happen where they cut things or break something, pull something out, and it just can shock them. Because electricity, to me, that's one of the things I fear the most, besides like hot surfaces with kids just thinking, oh, this is fine, this looks safe, and they get shocked.
You know, it's really interesting. I've been reading this book Tony Dungy wrote. He's a former coach of the Buccaneers and the Colts, and an interesting book just talking about his life. Well, they adopted some kids, and they adopted this one baby boy. They didn't know it at the time, but he has that odd condition where they don't feel pain. And they didn't know it, obviously, right away. And so he got seriously hurt because he loves cookies. He reached his hand into the oven and pulled out the cookie sheet and took the cookie off and ate it. And he never felt anything, but he had burned his hand and his throat and his mouth.
Oh.
They took him in, got him taken care of. Obviously, they discovered, wow, he's got this problem. But like Dungy pointed out in the book, pain's a good thing in the sense that it warns you. The kid just didn't know. He'd do stuff that other kids would do and say, I'm not going to do that again. But it never hurt him, so he just kept doing it.
That also just highlights the difference in kids' perspectives compared to an adult's perspective. It seems like adults, we naturally think of the possible dangers of everything, and the kids think of the possible fun activities they could have. I mean, with slime, they probably associate that with, you know, getting slimed on some of these kids' TV shows. You just dump a bucket of slime on someone's head. You would never, as a child, you would never think of chemicals burning your hands. If you see a whole bucket of it get dumped on someone's head, that's not your first expectation.
That's true. They're used to seeing it in that light. Here's an interesting story from CNN.com. I saw this one over the weekend, and there's a lot of reality shows out there. But there was one reality show. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of this one. The name of the show was Eden, and the idea was that these people were going to go to this kind of secluded area. I think it was in Scotland, and they were going to start a new civilization. They were going to follow them, and they had, like, remote cameras and all this. They canceled the show, but two of the contestants didn't know. And they they stayed there. They were there for an entire year, and the show was, like, canceled.
What?
Most of the other contestants left. They just didn't want to do it anymore, and they just took off. But two people stayed. And actually, it was even a few more than that, I guess. I don't know if it was two at the very end, but there was, I guess, 10 that stayed for quite a while. And they never told them that the show was canceled. They just moved on.
Wow.
So those people have been living out there for a year. And it was canceled in August after only four episodes. And they're still out there. They finally let them know, I think. they emerged a year later to a very different world. They didn't know that President Trump was elected. They had not heard of Brexit. They didn't know anything that had happened for a year.
Wow.
They were just left out there. Now, that should have been the reality show. I would have watched that after it ended.
Yeah, it's like the Truman Show, kind of, in a way, where they're just left there and they don't have any sense of the real world until they emerge from it. But it's just kind of, I don't know, irresponsible of the network, or maybe there's miscommunication, or who knows. But yeah, they're probably survival experts now if they weren't before.
Well, how you'd think everything you were doing was on television. Everyone's watching your big dramas, and the show's canceled. I've never heard of that. How strange. You would have thought the least someone could have done would be to send them a courtesy, message. Show's over. Go home. I don't know. I guess they could have just left them there maybe forever, and they would have started a new civilization, but somehow they figured out it was over and came out to a whole different world. That is interesting. You know, if you, like, went into a coma for a year or something, you know, coming back to and being like, hey, what happened in the world? That would be strange.
Yeah, so much has changed in the last year. Just imagine being that guy whose only job was probably to let the people know that the show was over, and he's just probably quietly tiptoeing into the background right now, hoping no one pinpoints him for being at fault here.
That would be an interesting email chain to read. So who was responsible for letting the contestants know? That's a good question. I wonder if there'd be a lawsuit there or something. You think there would be something in the contract that, hey, we'll let you know if this doesn't work out or whatever.
Yeah, maybe they just volunteered and they just assumed as long, like, for the year or whatever they were supposed to be there, that they're not going to contact us because...
That could be.
Because otherwise we'd, like, ruin the show, so...
Well, there was four camera people that were often there, and then all these robotics. So obviously at some... Well, I don't know if the camera people stayed or not. They didn't really say, but, I could see them leaving and still thinking, like, well, the robotics are picking up what's going on.
I see.
So because you would think, where's the production crew?
Right.
But, you know, maybe they thought, well, it'll just keep going, you know, with this other stuff. So that would be fascinating footage if they still have it.
Yeah.
It's funny because they, even though the show didn't work, the way it didn't work is actually more interesting than the show.
Right.
So if they made like a little movie about like the canceled reality show, now that would probably be interesting.
Wouldn't that be extremely liberating too? I mean, they haven't used the internet probably for a whole year if they don't know any of those things that have happened. So they've been living like people used to live hundreds of years ago.
Well, you know how it is. If you've ever been on a camping trip or something that lasted, you know, a few days or maybe a week, and you kind of cut off from some of your basic stuff, you come back with just a different perspective. And a nice one, actually. Mm-hmm. It doesn't last all that long because you get back into your normal routine. But it is nice to just kind of disconnect for a little bit. Not that we recommend that. You should keep up with thetrumpet.com. But as far as just like, you know, keeping up with every little, you know, entertainment story or whatever, it's kind of nice to just lose track of some of that.
Yeah, I remember, I think the power went out at my place for a little bit earlier last year. And so I couldn't use internet for a few days or watch TV or anything. And it was frustrating trying to charge my phone for an alarm clock. But other than that, it was nice just not having to worry about it. I could just go home and no one was going to, unless they called me or something, no one was going to contact me. And I could just relax, read, and do stuff I probably would have been too distracted to do in the first place.
Yeah, you find out you have probably more time than you think you do.
Yeah.
In an unrelated note, but I might as well add it in here, speaking of entertainment and sports, Oakland Raiders going to Las Vegas.
Right.
They're still in Oakland for, I think, 2 or 3 years, but then they're going to Vegas. They're going to be the Las Vegas Raiders. See how that works out.
It's the perfect place for a team named the Raiders to be. Just a team based on pillaging riches.
Yeah.
Now they're in Las Vegas.
Yeah. Well, all the, you know, the fans that dress up for the Raiders, they call them the Black Hole. Yeah. You know, that they won't even stand out. Yeah. Vegas. People won't know if they're Raiders fans or it's just a Tuesday night.
A black hole, like where your money goes in Vegas. Yeah. It all ties together.
That guy's dressed like Darth Vader. Is he here for the Raiders or he's just here for the buffet? We don't know what's happening. This is Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG, and online we're at kpcg.fm. You can follow us on Twitter at kpcgfm and email us comments at kpcg.fm. Grant, interesting story here about the Korean Peninsula from the Washington Times. Possibilities for reunifying the Korean Peninsula. I'm assuming that would mean getting rid of a couple of dictators or at least one.
Yeah, it does seem like an implausible solution right now. But this was written by John Bolton. He's a former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. So he does have some pretty well thought out ideas here. It's just a matter of, is this really a possibility at this point after 25 years of negotiating with North Korea to get rid of their nuclear weapons capabilities, or at least their technologies leading up to that? It hasn't worked at all. So it would almost seem like they need to get into the military side of things and topple the dictatorship in the north.
Yeah, it's interesting because I was thinking, who has ever really given up their weaponry? There's been a few nations that have, but in most cases they've then been betrayed. Like, who was it that gave up some of their weapons there in the
Ukraine?
Ukraine, yeah, Ukraine. But they did it under the condition was the U.S. had their back.
How'd that work out for them?
Exactly. So if you're North Korea, now North Korea is a whole other animal anyway, but if you're one of those nations, they don't want to negotiate anyway. But even if they did for some reason, the history says you're going to get betrayed. You're going to lose all of your power. I could see why they wouldn't want to do it.
Yeah, it's definitely tough situation for them, and of course they have received backing from China and Russia, and they've been in cahoots with Iran for about 25 years, coincidentally, maybe the same amount of time that the U.S. has been trying to negotiate with them. Clearly they're pretty well entrenched in their belief system and constantly spreading anti-U.S. propaganda, so really no negotiations on the U.S.'s behalf are going to convince North Korea to change anything at all.
Right, and then of course you've got China in the mix. Does Mr. Bolton bring out anything about China and their involvement?
Yeah, really it's all about China, because without China's cooperation, basically the U.S. would have to get involved in a proxy war supporting the South while China supports the North. What he brought out, though, was that some recent Chinese leaders, some of the younger Chinese leaders now have spoken openly about how North Korea is like a piece of dirty old baggage and that they kind of want to get rid of that connection to them. In the past, it when China was more communist than they would be considered right now, there was this idea that no communist regime should ever betray another. So it was almost like there was never a question in the past that China would continue to support North Korea.
Well, it's interesting. I wonder what they would do, what China would do with North Korea if they didn't want to keep supporting the regime that's there. But, you know, it's an advantage to them because it's a distraction for the West. And, what's the saying, you know? Well, I don't know. I guess it doesn't totally make sense, but I was thinking of that, you know, even if you're not best buds, if they're still an enemy of your enemy, they're your friend.
Right.
Right? Yeah, something like that. And so they're obviously so anti-U.S. it helps China, because China, as much as they're a little more sophisticated, they certainly are. Well, they're pro-China first. Well, let's put it that way.
Right. Yeah. And there are so many interesting details to these possibilities of reuniting the Korean Peninsula. For example, Japan and South Korea are imminently threatened by North Korea. I mean, pretty much every time North Korea conducts a nuclear test, and I believe they've done 6 of them, they launch it right next to South Korea or Japan, right off their coast, and it wouldn't take much for them to just launch one to their landmass. So, of course, that is a big problem in the region, but also the fact that they have been financing Iran or giving them ideas about their nuclear program as well. It just goes to show that North Korea is not just a regional problem. They're spreading their issues into the Middle East as well. And of course, they have so much backing from Russia, China as well. So it is a pretty complicated situation. But John Bolton also talks about how China could actually benefit a lot from this. They'd have a better reputation, of course, but also they would benefit from the Korean Peninsula being the way it was supposed to be. The peninsula was never supposed to be divided. It was supposed to be a really short-term solution. And I think they would actually do better with South Korea as a possible trading partner than someone like North Korea, which doesn't have much to offer them in anything.
Yeah, that would be a really good trading chip for them. You know, say, hey, look, we'll say to North or South Korea, look, we'll take care of North Korea and get rid of all of the issues there. But, you know, you're not going to be a Western ally. You're going to be a Chinese ally mm-hmm. now. That would definitely benefit them. And getting back to what you said about Japan, I even saw a headline today. What Japan has asked for, they want first strike capabilities from what I saw. I think it was first strike capabilities because of North Korea's belligerence.
Right.
So, and obviously, you know Japan's history in World War II. They were not supposed to militarize. And so it's interesting you have these rogue nations pushing and then people react to it. Do you want Japan to have first strike capabilities? You know, those are interesting questions.
That's the danger of North Korea by itself, because then Japan gets their weapons and then who knows what other nations might be provoked to get weapons in response to Japan having some. Obviously, Japan has some dark history in that region as well, and they have definitely hurt some of their neighbors. So some other nations would probably want to get weapons, and that is how nuclear proliferation happens. So that is really a danger there as well. And then also the other issue of uniting the peninsula is just the fact that there could be a refugee crisis. The North is obviously extremely underdeveloped. A lot of their land has gone toward, sadly, labor camps. And, you know, the people are in abject poverty there. So if they are all of a sudden united with South Korea, you could imagine a lot of them flooding south to where the land is better and where there are a lot more opportunities, at least in the short term. Or they could go north into China, which might make China not like the idea so much. The thing that John Bolton brings out is you might need to have a lot of resources ready for them in terms of humanitarian aid, so that as soon as the peninsula is reunited, at least the North would not feel like they need to flee elsewhere.
So does Bolton think that it should be reunited? He thinks that's something that should be done?
Well, he's just tired of 25 years of fruitless negotiations, and so he's saying, why waste a 26th year doing the same thing that has never worked? In the meantime, watch North Korea get more dangerous to everybody. It would seem like getting China on board would definitely help. Another drawback, though, is China doesn't necessarily want more troops stationed on the Korean Peninsula to uphold, you know, their toppling of the North Korean regime and keeping the peace there. So it does take a lot of chips to fall into place, but it is something to think about. It at this point, it just seems like a hypothetical sort of a world tomorrow like solution.
Is this an example? We talked about this yesterday. Is this an example of America wanting just to have a solution and get it done with, and China playing the long game and saying 25 years, that's fine. Yeah. We can keep pushing this until we get the deal we want, and the U.S. just so quick to want it to be done with that we make a bad decision.
Well, I think with China, as long as North Korea exists, it's not their problem because it's an American problem. North Korea is never going to bomb China. So as long as North Korea exists in the current status quo, China doesn't have to worry about anything in Korea. They don't have to worry about South Korea invading China. They don't have to worry about anything because North Korea is the buffer zone. And also, America is so busy dealing with North Korea, it's a smokescreen for Chinese ambitions elsewhere. So I think China, for the most part, they're just willing to let the U.S. spin their wheels there and look foolish year after year after year. Make it to their own people, make American government look foolish by they can't even beat off Pyongyang when we like can crush them in 1 second. So I think they use it for their propaganda too. So I think there are, like as Grant brought out, Ambassador Bolton, there's some great ideas there. But I think as long as China is opposed to America, they'll just use North Korea until it's worthless to them anymore. And if North Korea is worthless, who says China doesn't come in and conquer North Korea, make North Korea part like a Chinese province, which would be even worse in the long run.
It's interesting. We see the same situations in the Middle East in particular, where we keep talking about peace and negotiations and so on and so forth. And yet it's as divided as it's ever been. Time, money, resources, and no, some ideas that maybe are okay, but not the will to on all sides to really implement them.
Right. If we rewind back to the 1990s and we listen to Bill Clinton's statement on North Korea and how those nuclear negotiations were supposed to deter North Korea from ever getting nukes, that has failed. And yet we heard almost the exact same statement word for word from Mr. Obama about Iran recently. So it just goes to show that we're trying the same solutions. They're not working. We're not trying peace by strength, which definitely would work.
It's interesting. Some interesting ideas there from John Bolton, Washington Times. Possibilities for reunifying the Korean Peninsula. He's just kind of writing and commentating now, right? Well, there was some talk about him maybe getting in the Trump administration. That never happened, I guess.
Yeah, I think he was possibly being offered a job. I think he was interviewed for a couple jobs, but yeah. Trump chose other people. So
yeah.
I think he's just commentator. He writes and that kind of thing.
He's got some good insights, and he's had a lot of good experience there. So that's at the Washington Times. You can read the rest of that. Possibilities for reunifying the Korean Peninsula. Grant, thanks for bringing that to us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Trump Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG, and we're online also at kpcg.fm. Abraham, you've got a related story, and you two weren't even in cahoots on this. You just have related stories about what's going on over there in Korea. So it's pretty interesting. We'll tackle this one first. The Modern War Institute, the five fatal challenges of war fighting in Korea. What do they have to say?
Yeah, this is a really interesting article because it does go through five major difficulties that if the U.S. or South Korean troops engage in a land war, the topple of the regime, basically the odds of their success. And it's a good thing to look at, especially, I think, 2 weeks ago, Rex Tillerson, Secretary of State, said they're considering military action against North Korea if negotiations fail. And then, as Grant brought out, 25 years of negotiations haven't solved anything. In fact, North Korea is getting closer and closer to developing a warhead that can deliver a nuclear payload to America.
Yeah, they seem more radical now than they've been. I mean, they always have been, but it just seems even more radical now. Like, it's not they're not getting closer to the West; they're getting further away.
Yeah, well, I think for the son Kim Jong Un, for him to be justified, he has to go more and more radical to provoke America to seem like he's important in the world. Otherwise, he'll just look like he's not important if he does another course of action.
You know, I really feel for the people that live under that regime. And you know, there was that picture of him looking through his binoculars or whatever it was,
right,
at the latest attempt to launch something which didn't work. And you always have to think, oh, you know, for them, for the people that are involved in the project, because a lot of times people get killed when those projects don't work. I mean, so it's a bad situation all the way around, and you really feel for people that are under that type of a regime. It's terrible.
Yeah. Well, I think most people want it to end. I think the whole world, except maybe for China and Russia, would support the U.S. if they did use military action against North Korea. Maybe Iran, too, would object to it. But it's morally, there's every reason to do it. And even strategically, there is as well. And so I think with these five challenges, what's interesting is we can actually look back on the Korean War in the 1950s and see that America did have a great deal of difficulty fighting in Korea. And the Korean War is kind of the forgotten war in the American conscious. There's always talk of World War II in Vietnam, but the Korean War is kind of swept under the carpet like it didn't happen, even though we lost more troops in Korea than in Vietnam. Vietnam was more politically motivated in the media. So there's a lot of lessons we should learn from Korea. But let's get into these five challenges they have. And they're all really interesting because I think they show the weaknesses of the U.S. Army overall. So the first weakness would be digital and computer networks will function without interruption in combat. So basically, in order to be successful, the U.S. would have to assume that all their digital systems would work without interruption. And as Gerald Flurry has pointed out, that's the Achilles heel of the U.S. military's our reliance on satellites and digital things, especially in this case. North Korea is a country that has demonstrated their cyber capability to undermine our defense networks. And even China, if they want to cyber attack us while we're fighting there, it could also disrupt basically the whole way the American military communicates, coordinates with all their different groups, and coordinates air ground support. So that would be a huge problem we'd have to overcome if it did happen.
Yeah, even on a just kind of a much lighter note, but related, you know, I very often, if I am going someplace and I don't know where I'm going, I just use my phone, Google Maps or whatever. I don't even know if I might have a map in my car. I don't know. I haven't pulled it out in years. But if all of a sudden that capability wasn't there, I'd have a hard time if it was someplace I didn't know where to go. And that's, of course, just personal travel. But we're all so used to that. And then you look at like a military situation, which is far more sophisticated and important. And we rely so heavily on all that equipment working. And if it doesn't, then what are you left with? Your ability to navigate on your own, your ability to communicate somehow on your own, if you can do that, it would really just cut our line of communication, and we'd be sitting ducks, I think.
Yeah, well, I think soldiers in general, they know how to navigate without digital aids. So they would still be able to fight, but it would minimize our effectiveness by exponentially enable to fight a quick, decisive battle. Also, just on a side note quickly, a few years ago, China developed plans that the U.S. uncovered where they would use a nuclear weapon to create an EMP to wipe out, to basically neutralize America's digital devices. So if North Korea did something similar, they could just create an EMP and wipe out everything that needs a screen or a battery, that kind of thing. And even some of our modern tanks are electrically run, so we couldn't even use our tanks or bigger materials. But anyway, that's the first one, is basically our Achilles heel of reliance on technology. Second one, the ground forces will need to complete non-combatant evacuations. So in other words, during all the fighting, they'll have to evacuate civilians to different places to get out of the way. And they could be, this can cause a lot of problems with miscommunication, mass casualties. There's just so many contingencies with this that it could cause a lot of havoc and problems especially in South Korea.
Yeah, and this is, again, the Modern War Institute, the five fatal challenges of war fighting in Korea. And so they're taking a look at what the challenges would be if there was some sort of a battle there.
Yeah, a land battle, if ground forces were on the ground fighting. So just evacuating civilians is always difficult to do under fire. The third one is movement, maneuver, and supply routes will be fluid. So to assume that you'll have room to maneuver is a very poor assumption in Korea. As the history of the 1950s shows, the biggest problem with Korea is its geography. Korea is very mountainous. It's a high latitude where it can get very cold in the winter. And the roads are all on very narrow choke points. And all the rivers and mountains are facing the wrong direction. So you always have to cross constant mountain ranges one over the other instead of having a flat surface in order to use tanks and our firepower to our advantage. So this automatically gives the North Koreans chances to use ambush techniques and to maximize their firepower while it minimizes ours, because we just don't know the terrain like they do.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this would be the biggest difficulties that, as I think just looking back on the Korean War, a lot of Americans died just from poor understanding of geography, set being on the wrong hill, being caught in the valley when the enemy's everywhere else above you on the high ground. That sort of thing could happen a lot and could cause massive casualties, especially with modern weaponry. This isn't the 1950s. This is the 2000s where you have massive weapons that could cause mass casualties. So that's number three. Number four, and number four and five, I think, are tied together. They're both dealing with weapons of mass destruction, dealing with North Korea's nuclear weapons. There are around about 10,000 underground facilities in North Korea that we know of that house nuclear weapons. So the U.S. Army would have to secure every single one of those as they advance. So that would just be hugely difficult to do. And then also the fact of securing the nuclear silos themselves. How do you do that without them launching them, without them doing something in desperation? And basically, on their approach, the author here says that all these North Koreans, their whole lives growing up, they've learned to view Americans as evil. So when you have these guards at these nuclear silos see Americans approaching in full combat gear, they're probably going to freak out and could do something irrational that really could ruin everything. So the author, he's a major in the U.S. Army. He thinks that that would be the biggest difficulty, would be securing these nuclear weapons when your enemy is brainwashed to think that you're evil and you should be destroyed. That's just a really dangerous situation.
Yeah, that's amazing. Do you know off the top of your head what type of chemical weapons they have at their disposal? Do they have those as well?
They very possibly could. I think there are some evidences that they've had some kind of weapons like that. Throughout, they've used them on their own people.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing like sarin gas, but in case of conflict, they could probably purchase them if they wanted to, if the U.S. didn't set up a blockade or something like that. But yeah, we just don't. That's the problem, is we don't know their full capability because we just have so limited surveillance on them.
It's amazing. 10,000 underground facilities that they know of.
Yeah,
I didn't know that. That's a huge number.
Yeah,
it's amazing too because they. They obviously have some money to dump into things like that, and while the people, of course, are starving in a lot of cases or living very low. But they have enough money to build that stuff. It's amazing.
Yeah, well, I think one of the most revealing maps is if you look at the Korean Peninsula at night from space, South Korea is like shining. So many lights, and because they have electricity. If you look at North Korea, just Pyongyang has electricity, just that one city. The rest is total darkness.
Wow.
But I think we need to remember, underground, it's very sophisticated with all these different nuclear silos and facilities. Above ground, the people live in poverty, no electricity, no heating, no nothing. So on the surface, it looks backwards, but when you go underneath the ground, that's when you see this is the extensive network they've been building for generations.
Mm.
In that country, and to conquer those would be probably the most complex task the U.S. military has ever undertaken.
That's a very, very interesting point. and something that is new to me. I had not heard that before. Because you do look at North Korea and you think, well, yeah, I mean, they've got some nukes, but they're so, you know, impoverished, and you know, what kind of a force could they bring? But like you say, with all that underground infrastructure and weapons and so forth down there, that would be it's like one giant landmine.
Yeah.
In a way, a nuclear landmine. That would be a huge, huge undertaking. And of course, they don't even know all of it. You know, if we know of 10,000, how many don't we know about?
Yeah, exactly. And even, I think the author brings out with Afghanistan, the U.S. Army struggles to beat off some villagers with rifles in the mountains of Afghanistan. What about fighting an army that is probably trained by the Chinese using Russian and Chinese weaponry? What chances do we have of beating them without suffering massive casualties or having some kind of huge army to supplement our forces? I mean, we still haven't won in Afghanistan. If we can't beat the Taliban, how do we beat probably a pretty well-trained North Korean army fighting for survival? I mean, that's a pretty fearsome thought for all those American and South Korean soldiers who would have to fight them.
Yeah, really fascinating. The Modern War Institute, the 5 fatal challenges of war fighting in Korea, all those things they have to think about when they make their statements about possibly going and fighting in Korea. Of course, we don't expect to see anything much like that happen. Maybe a strike or two could happen, but who knows? But a lot to think about on the ground. You've got one other write-up for us today. This is pretty interesting. A little scientific note here. It's from The Guardian. People like dinosaurs, I think. Who doesn't like a dinosaur? The world's largest dinosaur footprints discovered in Western Australia. All of the scary animals are from Australia. The poisonous, the dangerous ones, according to the shows I've seen, and now they have the largest dinosaur footprint discovered. How large are we talking here?
So this footprint is 170 centimeters. So that's about 5 feet long. I encourage you to look at the picture, get an idea of it. But close to a 6 foot man can lay down and almost fit inside the footprint.
Wow. That's huge, obviously. And what dinosaur does this belong to?
So it's interesting. This part of Western Australia, it's called basically Australia's Jurassic Park because there's hundreds of footprints in this park because it's sandstone, so that made an impression. And they can identify 21 different types of dinosaurs from these footprints, which is astounding that they can even do that. So the particular one there, they think it's from a sauropod, a huge diplodocus, like herbivores with long necks and tails. So like a brachiosaurus, the big ones, 4 tails, the long necks, the long rambling around the earth. Those are the ones they think made these huge footsteps.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. So there's all these footprints there, and you'd think they would have seen them all, but apparently they keep finding different ones or... just discovering larger ones.
Yeah, with this is interesting because this part of Western Australia, it's under the protection of some of the Aborigines tribes.
Okay.
So they don't really have access to it. And this particular tribe is called the Gularabulu people. I think I said that right.
I don't think they're listening. But,
yeah. But they had this park that it was under their, they lived on, it was their preservation. They knew these footprints existed, they didn't tell anyone until they told some paleontologists. They came and investigated and were able to document them and everything for us today.
Yeah, well, that is interesting. It's amazing. You'd think that we've discovered everything there is to discover, but that's never the case. There's always something else out there that they find, and especially under the ocean, but even here where it's above ground, but they just hadn't gotten there before. And so it's funny because obviously the locals would be like, oh yeah, that big footprint, yeah, that's been there, you know, a long time. They knew all about it, but this is the first they've seen it. That's pretty amazing. So, I mean, obviously they've seen big ones before, but this is the biggest.
Yeah, this is the biggest on record. There's been some over 100 centimeters or a little over 3 feet before, but this one is by far the largest we've discovered, actually having a real footprint in the sandstone. So it's pretty exciting. They bring up an interesting point saying that these kinds of discoveries on these huge footprints, it shows that some of the dinosaur, if you use the premise of evolution, some dinosaurs couldn't have evolved into birds. Because how does a dinosaur with a footprint that big become a bird? Like, I'm glad they didn't, because that'd be a huge ostrich or whatever it's supposed to be. So evidence like this, I think, is interesting because it does break down that claim that birds evolved from the dinosaurs. Because how did something that big become anything else?
Right.
Like, isn't that a regression to become like a chicken when you're something that has a footprint that's 170 centimeters long?
Yeah, it's just amazing to think about how big those animals were. And I always kind of wonder if they like got it exactly right in terms of the way they looked, you know, because we all know how they think they looked based upon skeletal remains. So it's probably pretty close, but I always wonder if it's a little different than we thought, you know, if it's like a giant footed thing, but it's not that tall.
Yeah. That's actually, it reminds me of a Far Side cartoon I saw. It was about Bigfoot and it had these two big feet, but it was like a little, like 1 foot guy with just like these two huge feet running along, and the scientist was like, wow, that kind of ruins the romanticism of it all.
Right. It's just, giant feet, but he wasn't that big.
Yeah.
No, it probably is a huge animal. It's amazing. You find, you know, they find stuff all over. I mean, even not too far away from here, they find dinosaur remains and all of that. So as a kid, that was always sort of a fantasy to find something like that. Never did. but apparently there are places you can go and still look around and maybe find some things.
Yeah, this particular dinosaur, based off what they think it is, at a hip, it was probably 5 meters tall. So that's 15 to 20 feet at the hip tall this dinosaur was. So based off of its footprint size and everything. So, it's amazing. I love dinosaurs. So it's always fascinating to see how much more they learn about them and how much we do know about them based off of how little is left of them.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it's assumption, but I think they're pretty good assumptions based off of the pattern of creation of today. We can see what was left from before.
Anytime there's new dinosaur news, you got to talk about it. It's fascinating. You think we found it all, and then all of a sudden something else comes up. The world's largest dinosaur footprints discovered in Western Australia. That's from The Guardian.
Yes.
So you can check it out. It's worth checking out because you can see the picture, and that'll really give you some insight into what that thing looks like. Got to get some big Nikes for that guy. Make sure you listen for the Key of David program, Trumpet Daily Radio Show, coming your way here on KPCG. That's all the time we have for today on Trumpet Radio Live. Thanks for joining us. For myself, Dwight Falk, Grant Turch, and Abraham Blondeau, have a great rest of your Tuesday. Thanks for being with us, and we'll talk to you again tomorrow.
Listening to Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG.